have no time for rebuttal, so we will go on to the next case of the day, which is State versus Jeremiah L. I'm going to pronounce this again. Kelly, Ms. Kavanaugh, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chief Justice and judges of the Supreme Court. I am Leslie Kavanaugh, Assistant Public Defender on behalf of Jeremiah Conley. Officer Wiedner and other uniformed patrol officers arrested Jeremiah Conley after a 911 phone call regarding a car theft and after having their attention called to a car that looked suspicious to them. After pursuing Conley in the stolen vehicle and chasing him down on foot, after Conley abandoned the vehicle, Conley was taken down and handcuffed. After phone calls down to Central Police Headquarters, Sergeant Mitchell of the Auto Theft Unit directed Officer Wiedner and others to bring Jeremiah Conley to Omaha Police Headquarters for questioning. Before entering the interrogation room, Sergeant Mitchell ran Conley's record, noticed that there was a missing persons report, took the time to speak to Conley's mother for what she said was 5 minutes in a phone conversation, and also noticed that there was a recent report of Conley's car being perhaps the subject to an arson. She had also been told by Officer Wiedner that Conley had made some statement regarding a woman's life being something that officers should care about, and that Wiedner told Sergeant Mitchell that she should ask about what Conley meant by his remarks about the fact that police should be concerned about a woman's life. Sergeant Mitchell enters the room and establishes rapport with Conley by asking him about his legs. At no time does Sergeant Mitchell read him his Miranda rights, nor did Officer Wiedner or other uniformed patrol officers read Conley his Miranda rights when he was arrested.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt your recitation of the facts, but you're not suggesting that the officer had any reason to believe that her questions about his legs would elicit an incriminating response?
Not that, no. But once she starts asking incriminating questions, questions that are meant to elicit an incriminating response, at that stage, Miranda rights have to be read, and that is what we're suggesting. It's not the part of the legs, but at any point in time when she starts asking, so what happened to this person? What are you saying happened to this person?
When do you think that point in time occurred?
Fairly early on, she starts asking, he says that she's gone, you can't help her anymore, and she asks, in response to that, what is meant by that? These questions, are what did you do to her? What happened? Are obviously at that stage, and that's fairly early on in the conversation, are indeed, in fact, meant to elicit some sort of response that is no doubt incriminating, because the very question, what did you do to her, is bound to elicit an incriminating response. Sergeant Mitchell's not...
Why is bound to elicit an incriminating response?
Well, if someone is saying that someone's life is in jeopardy and then asking, the police responding and saying, well, what did you do to this person, I think that's a logical conclusion that one should expect, or at least it certainly suggests and it could be an incriminating response. It could also be a denial. But
if I may, could you help us out with a little bit with the timeline, because I think it might impact or inform us about the thinking of the officers. And at one point, Mitchell says, "Is she alive?" And the answer is, "No, she's not."
Right.
And then at some further point, Mr. Conley says, "What does that mean to you? Were you looking for other victims?" Do you know what the passage of time is in between those comments? And I'm trying to get that straight so that we can discern from the record how the officers may legitimately have been understanding his comments, and some of which is arguably incoherent or disconnected, but the two things to which I refer may bracket what a reasonable officer, or subjectively what these officers thought about the opportunity to rescue a victim. So I think the timeline would help us, please.
And you raise an important point, Judge, and that is that her question, his response of saying, "No, you can't help her anymore, she's dead." What ends up happening then at that stage is that Sergeant Mitchell gives a nod to the other officer in the room, Officer Groth, and then he gets up and leaves. And whatever everybody's testimony is that he goes and talks to the detective in the homicide unit. And that detective then starts monitoring the continued questioning by Sergeant Mitchell of her interrogation of Conley before he enters the room. And the part that you mentioned comes after that and is part of what the detective ultimately is monitoring and then asks about later on. So that's all of that, where it's clear that, any of these questions that she's asking, are you saying, that she's gone? I would even argue that the questions before are still intended to elicit an incriminating statement. And the reason why I would also argue that the state is in error here is because they're arguing that, well, this is protected by the rescue doctrine. And our argument is that if that was true, that we can't just use that as an excuse for not acting upon those, that if it was true that this was subject to the rescue doctrine, then efforts would be made to, in fact, undergo a rescue.
Do you have some indication at what point, let me back up, if I may. There is information that leads the detectives, or Mitchell in the first instance, to think there could be a death involved, right?
Yes.
And then under the rescue doctrine, I don't mean to be glib, they hop on it. Time is of the essence, right? Or do they hop on it? Thank you.
They don't. Mitchell does not hop on it at all. And in fact, no one contacts Fremont where he says that this happened. There isn't any evidence presented that, at that time that Sergeant Mitchell or anybody else alerts the Dodge County Sheriff's Office or the Fremont Police Department.
Officers attempt to find a location of the where the victim was?
Eventually, yes, but not during Sergeant Mitchell's interrogation, non-Mirandized interrogation. All Mitchell gets is Fremont. She doesn't get out any maps or anything else like that. That happens after Detective Preston has been monitoring this interrogation by Sergeant Mitchell and then enters the room. And
time-wise, how much later is that?
Well, I would say fairly early on, he monitors Mitchell for about 15 to 20 minutes And then there was a gap in time of about, I want to say about 5 minutes. And then they both, maybe even less than that. And then they both enter the room. And that's when Detective Preston takes over the interrogation. And as far as determination of where this happened, eventually they get to that. Maps are brought into the room. And then hours later, there is a effort at what they put Mr. Conley in a patrol car and take him to the Fremont area in
Miranda eventually given.
Miranda is given by Detective Preston when he enters the room. But again, we would argue that this is like Missouri versus Siebert, in which an interrogation takes place and which the questions by Sergeant Mitchell are designed to elicit incriminating statements, that they are in coordination, that it is monitored by Detective Preston, who then uses that information to jumpstart his interrogation, already knowing where he's going to go on that, since he already knows. Okay, so, you know, his initial questioning is, so you're saying that this happened in Fremont. Well, the only way that you could know that is if you had been monitoring the non-Mirandized statements that Jeremiah Conley gave. And so this is like Siebert. Sorry, Your Honor.
Which opinion in Missouri versus Siebert is the law that we're bound to follow? Is it the plurality opinion authored by Justice Breyer or Justice Kennedy's concurrence?
Kennedy's concurrence.
And does it matter?
It does, in that I think Kennedy says that it has to be intentional, but and therefore I think that that's probably what applies as being the majority opinion, because he narrows Justice Souter's plurality opinion to saying that it has to be intentional. But in here, you know, there isn't any question about the fact that what Sergeant Mitchell is doing is intentional. This is a 25-year veteran of the Omaha Police Department who's well-versed in police procedure. The idea that somehow she, forgot to give Miranda rights when she's questioning somebody, asking, is that what you say happened? What did you do to her?
Your argument is that this was bad faith and deliberate on the part of the police.
Well, I think it's rather evident after she gives a head nod to her to the officer Groth, who obviously clearly understands by a head nod, go get the detectives and let them know that they need to pay attention here. And they go about monitoring this interrogation, that clearly this is something that has been set up, that they have this system so that they can monitor interrogations as they're going on. And everybody knows, including Officer Groth, that no Miranda rights were read. So yes, this is a coordinated effort. And because of that being a coordinated effort, and there wasn't any evidence to show that it was not by the state, and it's their burden, we would argue that this statement given by Mr. Conley must be suppressed. The curative that Justice Kennedy suggests in Siebert did not occur here. The remedies that he suggests in his concurring opinion were that there either be a substantive break between questioning, and we would argue that this break in questioning is not sufficient, that it's clearly of a along a short spectrum in which there really isn't a break in between. It's not like he's moved from someplace else. Or there is an admonishment that perhaps his pre-Miranda statement may not be admissible. None of those curative steps are taken by officers. And so that which is suggested by Kennedy was not followed, and therefore the pre-Mirandized statement by Mitchell becomes so tainted by that monitoring by Detective Preston that it cannot be cured and therefore must be suppressed.
Is there a feature of the Kennedy concurrence with respect to subjective intent of the officers or objective intent of the officers? And if so, how does that inform our analysis?
I would have to defer to the court on that. I think that there is, it's unclear.
I beg your pardon, that may be a better question for the state, if I recall the briefing. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. With that, if there are any other questions, otherwise I'd reserve my time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Stacey Faust. I'm an assistant attorney general representing the appellee, the state of Nebraska. Connolly assigns and argues that his pre-Miranda and post-Miranda statements must be suppressed. There is no dispute that he was in custody. I will begin with Connolly's pre-Miranda statements to Sergeant Mitchell. Please note that although the entire interview was received into evidence, the state only published to the jury until 5:51 in the interview. And it appears from the record that the interview did not go back with the jury during deliberations, nor did the jury request to view it again. The most important statements that Connolly made during that period until 5:51 are that Gina Wilcoxon was lying naked in some ditch at the end of some road in Fremont with duct tape covering her face, and Connolly put her there. He said, "She's not alive and you can't help her no more." The district court found that Connolly's pre-Miranda statements to Sergeant Mitchell were voluntary and not obtained as a result of interrogation, and the state agrees. The touchstone of interrogation is that it occurs when a person feels compelled to speak. Statements made during a conversation initiated by the defendant or spontaneously volunteered by the defendant are not the result of interrogation. Interrogation is not a course of inquiry related to and responsive to a volunteered remark. And just because a statement by an officer ends in a question mark does not mean it is an interrogation. Rather, it must be viewed in the context that it is made. Here, Connolly was under no compulsion to speak. He was arrested on an auto theft. And while waiting for an interview room and unsolicited, he told Officer Widener that they should be concerned about somebody's life. And once in the interview room, other than complaining about his sunburn, the first thing Connolly spontaneously told Sergeant Mitchell was that his sunburn or injuries was from dumping her body in Fremont. He was visibly upset that no one knew about Wilcoxon. And so imagine being in Sergeant Mitchell's position and hearing that. Here she thought she was going to interview Connolly about a misdemeanor auto theft, and instead he surprises her about dumping a body, and she has no idea what he's talking about. And here I'd like to break for a moment, because Sergeant Mitchell testified at the suppression hearing that she did not remember Officer Widener telling her to ask Connolly about somebody's life or about a missing woman. She believed that she might have misunderstood him and thought he was talking about the missing person report that was filed on Connolly by his mother. She testified that she had no idea what Connolly was talking about when he brought up Wilcoxon, and the district court accepted her testimony. And Connolly wants the court to disturb that credibility finding, which this court cannot do. So she says, "Well, tell me, I'll listen," which she was entitled to do based on his volunteered remark and in an effort to calm him and to establish rapport with him because he's so upset. And so Connolly continued to talk and talk, often not in direct response to Sergeant Mitchell's questions. And a prime example of that is, as the district court found, his response to Sergeant Mitchell's question at the end, all she says is, where you been hanging out? You've been hanging out in the van?" And instead, he responds and chronicles how he he tells her how he sexually assaulted, suffocated, and killed Wilcox. And that's not in response to her question. And so, in other words, Connolly, he wanted to speak. He wanted to tell Sergeant Mitchell about what he did to Wilcoxon, and that's what he did. And the district court, in the state's opinion, did not err in finding that there was no interrogation in that first interview with Sergeant Mitchell. Alternatively, the state agrees with the district court that Connolly's pre-Miranda statements were admissible under the rescue doctrine. The rescue doctrine and what...
Have we ever addressed the rescue doctrine?
No, this court has not. And so, yes, it would be the state's asking if the court should choose to go this route to adopt the rescue doctrine, which is also termed the private safety exception. It excuses compliance with Miranda because of the need to save a human life or to rescue a person in danger. It predates Miranda, but it has survived long past. And it's a variation of the public safety exception that the U.S. Supreme Court adopted in New York versus Quarles. In some states, including California until 2009, there are three factors in determining whether the rescue doctrine applies to a case. And the first one is urgency of need in that no other course of action promises relief. The second is the possibility of saving human life by rescuing a person whose life is in danger. And three, the subjective intent of the interrogator and the primary purpose of that interrogator is rescue. The California Supreme Court has rejected the third factor in light of Quarles because the Supreme Court found in Quarles that the public safety exception does not depend upon the subjective motives of the officer. Here, the district court analyzed all three factors and found that all three were met. And the state agrees, should this court also look at the third factor, that all three were met. Connolly did tell Sergeant Mitchell that Wilcoxon was not alive and that they couldn't help her no more. She wasn't required to accept what he said as true. And I would submit, as the prosecutors did below, she would be derelict in her duties to have done so. It is the possibility of saving another life that is important, not the probability. This isn't a case where the officers even knew that a crime had been committed. Sergeant Mitchell had no idea what Connolly was talking about, and he was her only source, in fact, her best source of information, so that no other course of action but questioning him was going to provide any relief. And she needed enough information from him to be able to validate that he was not just deflecting from the auto theft, and to be able to find Wilcoxon, hopefully, alive. Even Detective Preston testified that when he entered that interview room, he still didn't know if Connolly was talking about the same Gina Wilcoxon who he had found in the system or whether she was safe or not.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if the state is asking this court to consider adopting the rescue doctrine or a public safety exception to the Miranda rule, what is the state's position on the most principled element of that rule? Your briefing addresses several different things, but doesn't really advocate for one over the other as I read it. And I'd like to know the state's position. If you're wanting us to consider an entirely new rule, what is the most perfect formulation of that rule?
Whether it should be the three factors or the two factors?
Correct.
In most Fourth and Fifth Amendment contexts, the subjective motivations of the officer are not considered. And so I think probably because this is a variation of the public safety exception that the U.S. Supreme Court adopted in New York versus Quarles, and Quarles does state that it is the objective motive, the subjective intent of the officers do not matter. I think that I would agree with the state of California and other state courts that say it is the two factors that matter.
Do you think at some point, I beg your pardon, do you think at some point, if we were to say the officers objectively were listening to the defendant, that they would have objectively concluded there's no rescue to be had based on what he said.
No, I don't think, I mean, here, I think we have to put ourselves, not subjective intent, but I think you have to look at the surrounding circumstances of this interview and how it came about. And you have Connolly shocking and surprising her with this new information. And while we can sit here in hindsight and look at everything, because I don't mean this to say that he was rambling and incoherent and so forth as appellant would see it, because I think in hindsight, you look at his statements as a whole, you can absolutely tell he knew exactly what he was saying, and everything relates to Wilcoxon and the events of her death and their relationship.
But I'm focusing, perhaps, I believe this was during the Mitchell part of the proceedings. Is this correct, where she says, is she alive? And the defendant says, no, she's not. So at that point, would a reasonable officer say there's no rescue to be had, and proceeding as though we're in the pigeonhole with rescue doctrine would not therefore make sense, and we're back to conventional Miranda jurisprudence? For example, was this all volunteered, for example?
Sure. Absolutely. The state's position is this rescue doctrine is absolutely an alternative to its position that there was no interrogation, this was completely voluntary. But I think that also segues into consideration of this rescue doctrine exception and whether a reasonable officer, when this suspect on an auto theft comes in and starts talking about dumping bodies in Fremont and leaving them in ditches, it is an officer sitting there going to believe him? And he says, no, she's not. I don't think an officer should be required, nor should Sergeant Mitchell have just stopped there and not tried to gather more information about him. Is this true? And can we find out a location and maybe save her? I think even in the California case of State versus Dean, it was longer than now, or at least days, in which they held the rescue doctrine exception applied, where they didn't know what had happened to the kidnapped victim. I think a reasonable officer on these facts, how this interview began, is not and should not be required to accept what he said is true.
When Connolly detailed the manner of death and how he said he killed her, did that occur during Mitchell's portion of the statement, or was that during
Towards the end of Sergeant Mitchell's, he does talk about sexually assaulting her and suffocating her and choking her to end it. However, it was during Detective Preston's interview, where, because that was an interrogation, and Detective Preston made Connolly chronicle from start to finish everything that happened with the events of Wilcoxon's, of their two-day relationship or whatever he thought it was, and up to her death. And that, at the end of that second interview with Detective Preston, is where it gets horribly graphic and detailed of exactly what he did to her, where his actions of that night, his journey, if you would call it that. I mean, that is where we really get everything. I also want to mention that for purposes of the rescue doctrine, that for Sergeant Mitchell's questioning, rescue doesn't need to be the sole purpose. She testified how she was really trying to discern also, was this a fantasy? Is he telling the truth? But she really came to believe there might be somebody who needs saving here. And so I just want to point that out, that for the rescue doctrine to apply, it doesn't need to be solely about rescue. Same with the public safety exception. They said that in Quarles. So I will move on to Connolly's post-Miranda statements. if this court finds no Miranda violation occurred during the interview with Sergeant Mitchell, then this court should find that Connolly's post-Miranda statements were properly admitted. He waived Miranda at the beginning, and there was no coercion, and his statements were otherwise voluntary under due process considerations. If this court should find that a Miranda violation occurred during the first interview, then this court should still find that Connolly's post-Miranda statements properly were admitted because, one, Siebert doesn't apply to the facts of this case, Oregon versus Elstad does, and it was not violated. Or two, if Siebert does apply, then there was no violation of Siebert. Both Elstad and Siebert involved two-step interrogations, the first unwarned and the second warned. And the issue in both was whether the warned statement should be suppressed. In Elstad, the inquiry was on the voluntariness of the statements. If the unwarned statement and warned statement were both voluntary or uncoerced, then only the unwarned statement was suppressed. Siebert is a plurality opinion, as this court discussed with counsel. Justice Kennedy wrote a concurrence, and several courts have recognized his concurrence as the controlling authority in Siebert. He focused on the subjective intent of the officer. And although, as this goes to Justice Miller-Lerman's question, he didn't explicitly say to look at the subjective intent of the officer, several courts have found that was implicit in his concurrence, that you should look at the subjective intent of the officer. And only if the officer deliberately questioned first and warned later would he apply curative measures resembling the Justice Souter's objective factors to determine the effectiveness of the Miranda warnings. And if the officer did not deliberately fail to warn, then Elstad applies to determine the admissibility of the warned statements, according to Kennedy. And here, the district court found Connolly's post-Miranda statements admissible when looking at both the concurrence and the factors as set out by Justice Souter. The state submits that Justice Kennedy's concurrence controls, and the record supports the district court's finding that Sergeant Mitchell did not deliberately question Connolly without first warning him. I do not see how she can deliberately question him about something that he blindsided with. And I think what sometimes gets lost in the lower court decisions is that Siebert involved a department protocol where officers intentionally did not give Miranda until interrogation produced a confession. There was no such department protocol here. This case squarely falls within Elstad, and because of all Connolly's statements were voluntary, aka uncoerced, his post-Miranda statements were properly admitted. But even if the multi-factor test reveals that this court looks at the multi-factor test, the Miranda warnings were still effective. If you look at them under Justice Kennedy's deliberateness test, it still shows there was no deliberateness here. There was some overlap, as the district court found, but Sergeant Mitchell's questioning was not systemic, exhausted, and managed with psychological care, as the court worried in Siebert. Detective Preston's questioning, on the other hand, was very detailed. It was very focused. He led the second interview, not Sergeant Mitchell. And the state submits that Detective Preston did not treat the second interview as continuous with the first as contemplated in Siebert. In Siebert, the same officer pressured and confronted the suspect with her prior statements so that she would repeat them after the Miranda warnings, saying such things as, "Therese, didn't you tell me that he was supposed to die in his sleep?" Here, Detective Preston, he missed parts of the first interview, and he only halfway listened to the rest while he was trying to determine if Wilcoxon was real. So he asked Connolly to start from the beginning, but he asked Connolly open-ended questions, and over an hour and a half, Connolly chronicled how he met Wilcoxon, their two-day relationship, how he killed her, how he disposed of their property, how he discarded her body, where he discarded her body, in so much more detail than was ever asked for or presented during the first interview. So in short, whichever approach this court chooses to take, the district court properly admitted Connolly's post-Miranda statements. And further, if this court finds that, then really the first interview with Sergeant Mitchell, that portion that came in is harmless. Because, like I said, this was the interview that mattered. I'll address Connolly's third assigned error if this court has any questions. Otherwise, I would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 4 minutes and 37 seconds.
4 minutes and 37 seconds. Ms. Kavanaugh.
You're muted. Sorry. I want to address the state's suggestion that somehow, because the jury only heard part of the statement, that somehow harm was not done. And I don't know whether Ms. Faust didn't directly say that, but I think that's a suggestion, that because only part of it was given to the jury. Understand that all of the statement was given to the district court when ruling upon the motion to suppress. And obviously, defense strategy and state strategy is determined by how the district court rules. So whether ultimately the state chose to present all of its statements, still the effect of a motion to suppress affects the entire outcome of the case. Turning to Sergeant Mitchell, the claim that somehow she was overwhelmed by this statement that was given to her by Conley is belied by the actual tick-tock of what actually happens. She asks questions, he responds. It's not as though he is talking on top of her. She asks questions and he responds to those questions. And if she is somehow sidetracked from a auto theft, that is belied by the fact that she never, in fact, asked about the auto theft. The safety concern.
Is there an argument that, in fact, the officer knew about the homicide?
No, although certainly there is evidence from Officer Wiedner that may be a direction in which one should pursue. Just because Sergeant Mitchell said that she didn't recall that doesn't mean that there wasn't evidence that, in fact, there was a tip by Officer Wiedner that line of questioning shouldn't be pursued. Second of all, you know, we are talking about reading Miranda warnings. It's not you can only start at the beginning or, you know, and there isn't any opportunity for Sergeant Mitchell to somehow stop when she can tell that something is going on and read off of the form that the Omaha Police Department uses that's available to anybody in that interrogation room and read those and assure that the Miranda warnings were read and then proceed on, that is somehow cumbersome is illogical. She certainly had that opportunity to do that at any time. The fact that she did not, the fact that she gave a head nod to Officer Groth to notify the detectives of the homicide unit, and then that interrogation was monitored, means that there was a coordinated effort, and that is what we're talking about. And that is why Siebert applies. If there had not been evidence of a coordinated effort, then perhaps the state's argument about Siebert not applying would take place. But here, I don't think that there's a distinction between a monitoring of an interrogation and then using that information to then go forward with your own interrogation, that there is a distinction between that and the same kind of interrogation that happens in Siebert.
How do you respond to Ms. Faust's suggestion that even if the un-Mirandized Mitchell interview was improperly admitted, it would be harmless in view of the Mirandized material, subsequent Mirandized material. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. And then, and again, it would be different if Detective Preston had just been said, you need to come in and talk to this guy. But because he had been monitoring it, because he had the benefit of listening to an un-Mirandized interrogation, he knew exactly where to go. And there was a conversation between him and Officer Groth regarding what was going on. And in fact, there was consultation, I think, that Detective Preston said that there was also a conversation during that break with Sergeant Mitchell to discuss what had gone on in the room. So not only was there monitoring, but there was a consultation with all of them before they re-entered the room. Well, obviously he benefited from that un-Mirandized interrogation that Sergeant Mitchell participated in. I see that my time is up.
Thank you very much. That concludes court's WebEx arguments for this morning. Very much appreciate everybody involved with this process. We will now have arguments from a number of cases that will take place personally in the courtroom, but the court is going to take a 15-minute break at this point in time, which I calculate to be approximately 10:45. So again, thank you very much for everybody with our WebEx arguments. We will begin in-person arguments in the courtroom at 10:45. Thank you, everybody. Justice Miller Lerman, you can just stay tuned, but you can break also.
Staying tuned. Thank you all.